In 1995, we all held our collective breaths to see what the Supreme Court was going to do in the case of Egan and Nesbitt versus Canada. It's hard to capture for somebody who lives in a world in which equality for queers is taken for granted how much doubt there was that we would ever actually succeed.
It is a confusing judgment.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The Belize Chief Justice overturns an anti-gay law against carnal intercourse, Georgia's president vetoes a marriage equality referendum, and Canada's first equality case kicks off a queer decade. Those stories and more this week now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 13th, 2016. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Belize on August 10th overturned the part of the Central American nation's criminal code that outlaws carnal intercourse against the order of nature, which includes private consensual adult same-gender sex. Belize, a country of some 380,000 people on the Caribbean coast, neighboring Mexico and Guatemala, has had the law in place since its days as a British colony. Chief Justice Kenneth Benjamin decided that Criminal Code Section 53 contravenes guarantees of personal dignity and privacy in the Belize Constitution, and that it violates constitutional guarantees of equal treatment for all people under the law. Benjamin's lengthy ruling noted that the court could consider, but could not act on, prevailing views of the societal majority, particularly religious views, that stigmatize men who have sex with men, whether or not those men identify as gay. He noted that decriminalization would help accelerate the fight against HIV/AIDS, especially among those men who often don't get tested or treated. For Caleb Orozco, a Belizean gay man and prominent human rights activist, this week's ruling was a successful culmination of the lawsuit he originally filed in his nation's highest court in May 2013. For Morris Tomlinson, an openly gay lawyer fighting a similar law in Jamaica, the Belize ruling could be highly persuasive in overturning such laws in the entire region.
President Georgi Margvelashvili of Georgia announced this week that he would not allow a proposed referendum calling for a constitutional ban on marriage equality to go before the voters. Right-wing politicians in the former Soviet Republic spearheaded a petition drive that gathered more than 200,000 signatures calling for the referendum, and the socially conservative nation's Central Election Commission had already cleared the way for a vote, pending the approval of the president and the prime minister. Margvelashvili said during a presidential press briefing on August 9th that the public vote was unnecessary because the country's civil code already defines marriage as between one man and one woman. He said those who support a constitutional amendment could push for passage of an appropriate bill in parliament. Prime Minister Georgi Varikashvili said this week that he favored the proposed constitutional amendment. Supporters of the referendum charged that Margvelashvili had been influenced by lobbyists out to protect homosexual rights. They vowed to go to court to challenge the presidential veto.
Serbia's newly re-elected Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić announced this week that he wants Ana Brnabić to join his cabinet as Minister of Public Administration. So why are leading LGBT rights activists in the Balkan countries celebrating? Brnabić is an out lesbian who does not hide her sexuality. She speaks about it proudly, Vujicic said during a news conference. He was only interested in how professional and hardworking she is, adding that, she has exquisite energy and I am looking forward to working with her. What makes this news particularly noteworthy is that the socially conservative country has a generally poor record on LGBT rights and has a politically powerful and vocally anti-LGBT Orthodox church, which claims more than 80% of Serbia's 7 million people, and that Vujicic leads the oxymoronically named right-wing Serbian Progressive Party. He was first elected in 2014. According to Agence France-Presse, Brnabic, who studied in Britain, has led Serbia's National Alliance for Local Economic Development, a public-private association that aims to improve the country's business environment. A news release from the Southeast European nation's Gay-Straight Alliance called the appointment a historic moment that will undoubtedly contribute to a greater acceptance and understanding of the LGBTI community.
But recently elected Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte went on a rant this week against Philip Goldberg, the U.S. ambassador to the country, during a televised speech to the nation's military elite, calling him bakla, which some say is crude slang for gay, and a son of a bitch. Goldberg had criticized then-presidential candidate Duterte for crude comments he made as mayor of Davao City about the brutal rape and murder of Jacqueline Hamill, an Australian missionary. What a pity, he said at the time. She was so beautiful. The mayor should have been first. The Australian ambassador was equally critical, but for whatever reason, Duterte focused on Goldberg, accusing him of meddling during the elections, giving statements here and there. He was not supposed to do that. The Obama administration is not amused. The Filipino charge d'affaires, Patrick Chua Soto, has reportedly been summoned to the State Department for an official rebuke. Goldberg has never publicly come out. In 2014, however, a year after he was sworn in, he hosted an LGBT pride reception at the U.S. ambassador's residence outside Manila. So he's at least an ally.
In other news, a U.S. district court heard a challenge on August 12th to the Obama administration's guidelines on the fair treatment of transgender students in federally funded public schools and universities. Lawyers representing Texas and a dozen other states charged that they forced school districts to mix the sexes in intimate areas. The guidelines tell public school districts that they must allow trans students to use the bathrooms and locker facilities that conform to their gender identity, or face the possible loss of millions of dollars in federal funding. Austin Nimux, Associate Deputy for Special Litigation for Texas, told U.S. District Court Judge Reed O'Connor that Congress made it very clear that the sexes could be segregated, male or female. These are the two sexes. Republican Attorney General of Texas Ken Paxton, who was not present at the hearing, filed the suit on behalf of the state's Tiny Herald Independent School District. While the district has never knowingly had a transgender student, Paxton said they want to preemptively ensure that the district isn't punished for simply following common sense policies. The lawsuit asks the court to issue an injunction against enforcement of the guidelines while the case works its way up the judicial ladder. Benjamin Berwick, a Justice Department attorney, argued that they have identified no action being taken against them, no threat of action being taken against them. O'Connor, who was appointed by George W. Bush, did not immediately decide the issue, but said that he would try to rule as soon as possible. Rest assured, he said, I'm working on it. The other plaintiffs in the lawsuit include Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Utah, Wisconsin, the Arizona Department of Education, and far-right Maine Republican Governor Paul LePage.
Mississippi's Republican Governor Phil Bryant suffered another legal setback this week. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on August 12th refused to lift a lower court order banning implementation of the Hospitality State's draconian religious freedom law, which allows both private and public workers to refuse to serve people who don't comport with their sincerely held religious beliefs or convictions. The law clearly targets civil marriage equality and would allow county clerks in Mississippi to refuse to issue licenses to gay and lesbian couples. HB 1523 specifically protects three beliefs or convictions: that civil marriage is only between one man and one woman, that only married couples should engage in sexual intercourse, and that a person's gender is determined at birth and is immutable. U.S. District Judge Carlton Reeves found the law to be unconstitutional because it favors one religious ideology over others and creates inequality for LGBT people. He issued his order against implementing the law just days before it was to go into effect on July 1st. Reeves did not mince words. Issuing a marriage license to a gay couple, he wrote, is not like being forced into armed combat or to assist with an abortion. Aside from refusing to lift the stay, the Fifth Circuit also denied Bryant's request for an expedited appeals process.
And finally, infamously homophobic Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore may be on the way out again. A state judicial panel on August 8th refused to dismiss an ethics complaint against him and set a September 28th hearing date on accusations that Moore urged all 68 Alabama probate judges to deny civil marriage licenses to same-gender couples, thus defying the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 marriage equality ruling. Chief Judge Michael Joyner of the Alabama Court of the Judiciary, a state panel that disciplines judges, refused dueling requests to either dismiss the complaint against Moore outright or immediately remove him from office. Moore was removed from office by the same court in 2003 for refusing to tear down a Ten Commandments monument he'd installed outside the state judicial building, though he was later reinstated. He could now be ousted as Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice for a second time.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 13th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
We'll thumb through books about an Australian drag queen and a pioneering New York Times HIV/AIDS writer, and an award-winning radio journalist recalls how Canada got to be that way, later in the program. As the 2016 Summer Olympics continue in Rio de Janeiro, Team LGBT has had its moments of athletic glory and journalist ingloriousness. British synchronized diver Tom Daley won a bronze medal with his swimming partner Daniel Goodfellow, but the television coverage ignored the presence of Daley's life partner, Oscar-winning Milk screenwriter Dustin Lance Black, a star power detail that probably would not have been overlooked had the engaged couple been straight. This Way Out made our own faux pas for reporting last week that New Zealand's 2012 bronze medal rower Robbie Manson had repeated his win this year. He and his rowing mate won a qualifying heat, but narrowly finished out of medal contention. Via culpa. The Brazilian women's rugby team just missed their event's knockout rounds, but player Isadora Cerullo came away with a prize of her own. The first marriage proposal of the Rio Olympics was offered by her girlfriend, volunteer stadium manager Marjorie Enya. Enya took up a microphone for a moving declaration on the pitch after the medals were awarded. As her teammates cheered, Cerullo said, "Yes." However, athletes and activists around the world said no to an article in the Daily Beast that recklessly placed gay Olympians in jeopardy. Straight married reporter Nico Hines used Grindr to track down gay athletes for a story on sex at the Olympics with enough details that closeted gays from hostile countries could be identified. After trying to edit the identifying details out of the story, the Daily Beast eventually removed it altogether with an apology. Pressure from the International Olympic Committee led Hines to being recalled from Rio. Still to come, Canada's queer decade, but first...
Extra, extra, read all about it.
It is indeed a very queer world, as illustrated by two books from two corners of it. Our queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason explains.
One is called From Darkness to Diva by Sky High, a leading Australian drag queen. The other is Dying Words, the AIDS reporting of Jess Maltz, and how it transformed the New York Times, written by Samuel G. Friedman, with Curry Donahue. In From Darkness to Diva, O Books, an imprint of John Hunt Publishing Limited in the UK, the tall gay man who took Sky High as his drag name writes of growing up gay and being so badly bullied that he had to leave high school. High writes unflinchingly about the beatings he endured, but also delves into the self-examination and spiritual lessons that he experienced. He also writes of the trials and triumphs of finding a gay community and of the liberation he experienced in entering the transformative world of drag. He had to leave his first high school because he was bullied, and after working several years, returned to another high school for his degree and was bullied again. High explores how he felt as he eventually stood up to the bully. I now had the power over him. I was in control. In that moment, I finally felt vindicated. It was as though my actions would have been justified had I wanted to snap his neck and kill him. But ultimately, he showed mercy on the bully and let him go, explaining that he felt saddened by the sight of him helplessly lying on the floor. Dying Words is reporting of Jess Smoltz and how transformed the New York Times, City University of New York, CUNY, Journalism Press, is a moving tribute to Jeff, who died at the age of 39. By the time the book presents his reportage on the AIDS epidemic, the reader feels a kinship with him. I think often of the dozen friends who have died of AIDS, and I feel them with me. It's not that I am writing editorials avenging their deaths. It's that I feel their strength, their soothing me on. They are my conscience, their shadows with me everywhere, in the torchlight of the march, over my shoulder, by my desk, in my sleep. Jeff had to break out of the box of the Times' impeccable third-person reportage into the finding of his own voice. Participant journalist doesn't quite describe it, but it comes close. Former Times colleague Samuel G. Friedman writes eloquently in the foreword about the reasons that he put the book together. For lack of a better term, I felt survival guilt, and beyond it, I grieved that as the years passed, fewer people would remember who Jeff Smoltz was and what tremendous work he had done. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and leisure for This Way Out.
Hi, this is Janice Ian. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
In 10 amazing years, life for LGBT people in Canada underwent dramatic changes. Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 is a documentary produced for CITR in Vancouver, British Columbia by veteran This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching. It reviews the era from the first Supreme Court of Canada ruling on equal rights to civil marriage equality. Part 1 focuses on the initial court case that began to turn the tide.
If you live in Vancouver, you probably know what the Davie Village looks like. It's got rainbow crosswalks at Davie and Butte, and a big colorful mural on the wall of Community. The bus shelters and garbage cans are pink, and there are purple Davie Village banners on the lampposts. They're symbols of a time when this was a gay mecca, when the West End was an affordable middle-class neighborhood, and queers flocked here from all over Canada to find each other. One of the high-rises was affectionately known as Vaseline Towers. I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage. On January 1st, 1995, there were no rainbow crosswalks and no purple banners on Davie Street. The gayest looking thing in the West End was an outrageous cafe called Doll and Penny's. It had a full-size red sports car and life-size department store mannequins on top of its marquee. The sign in the window said, "Sorry, we're open." Community was just a dirty white building called the Gay and Lesbian Center. The floor was a patchwork of filthy, mismatched carpets. The real center of the community was Little Sister's bookstore. It was still in its old location on Thurlow Street, on the top floor of an old converted house. The stairwell had a landing halfway up that was like the gay Craigslist of the 1990s. It was wallpapered with event posters and handwritten notices offering rooms to rent or furniture for sale. When I first started going there, I keep my eyes open for suspicious packages while I was walking up those stairs. The store had been bombed 3 times. Most people didn't know it then, but at the start of 1995, we were heading towards a court decision that was about to change our lives.
My name is Barbara Finlay. I am a fat, white, old, cisgender, lesbian lawyer who grew up working class and was raised Christian on the prairies. I live with disabilities. I've done a lot of work for lesbians, gay men, bisexual, and transgender people. And I taught in the Faculty of Law at UBC. You can work that in somewhere. By the time 1995 rolled around, British Columbia had added sexual orientation as a protected ground under the Human Rights Code. Canada had not yet done that. However, the big news in the previous decade was that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms had come into effect with its equality section in 1985. That law provides that everyone has the right to be free from discrimination, and in particular, discrimination based on race, sex, ancestry, place of origin, religious belief, or physical or mental disability. You'll notice that missing from that list was sexual orientation. The court decided early on that those words, quote, and in particular, unquote, meant that the list of protected grounds in the Charter was not a closed list. It was an open list, and if you could demonstrate that you were a member of a group historically marginalized, that you would be entitled to Charter protection. So, that was the situation in 1995 when we all held our collective breaths to see what the Supreme Court of Canada was going to do in the case of Egan and Nesbitt versus Canada. Egan and Nesbitt were two senior citizens. One of them retired. When the second one retired, he applied for a spousal benefit available under a federal program to the spouses of people whose income was below a particular level. They were refused because in the eyes of the law, they weren't spouses. The argument was this. As gay men, Egan and Nesbitt were part of a group of people in Canadian society who had been historically marginalized and discriminated against, and were therefore entitled to the protection of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There were two reasons we held our breath. Most commentators expected that sexual orientation would be added to the list of prohibited grounds. But lots of commentators were not sure whether that would be extended to our partners. If I'm protected on the ground basis of sexual orientation, then you can't refuse to hire me in the military because I'm a lesbian, for example. But separately, when you hire me in the military, do you have to give spousal benefits to my partner? It's actually hard to capture for somebody who lives in a world in which equality for queers is a taken-for-granted feature of our existence, how much doubt there was that we would ever actually succeed in asserting that we deserved to be treated as human beings. I was terrified.
A lot of my friends who are not...
This is me on Queer FM, 2 days after the decision came down in May of 1995. I'm talking to Lawrence Aronovich of the gay lobby group AGAL.
Well, it is a confusing judgment. It was basically a 4-1-4 decision amongst the nine justices. All nine judges agreed that sexual orientation must be read into the Charter of Rights as a ground of discrimination analogous to the existing grounds, for example, race, sex, religion, and so forth. But above and beyond that, five of the nine judges, which is a slim majority, but nevertheless a majority, agreed that the refusal to recognize same-sex relationships in this case constitutes discrimination. Okay. So a majority ruled that relationships, never mind sexual orientation for the individual, but same-sex relationships are covered by Section 15.
Okay.
Mm. What happened is that one of the five judges also said that even though it's discriminatory, Parliament has the right to make that kind of discrimination, and that's what's called a Section 1 exclusion.
So exactly how does a judge justify discrimination, you ask? Justice John Sapinka wrote that the court needed to give the government time to accommodate what he called, quote, new social relationships. I will pause here to point out that Egan and Nesbitt had been in a relationship for 47 years. But basically, the court was saying this. Yes, gay people are equal to straight people. And yes, gay relationships are equal to straight relationships. But we're not going to force the government to give you that equality just yet. Make no mistake about it, though, this was a massive victory. Because after Egan, there was no more question of if we had rights. There was only a question of when. Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
Stay tuned for more from Heather Kitching's award-winning documentary about Canada's queer decade, 1995 to 2005, on future editions of This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael Lebeau, Jessica Andrea, Janet Mason, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. John Williams, The Who, and Triumph performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CHMA Sackville, New Brunswick, WHRW Binghamton, New York, KALW San Francisco, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.